Okay, I'm Greg Johnson. Ask me anything. I have a few philosophical questions here, and I want to get them all out of the way in 1 hour or so of AMA. So Peter has written to me, and he said, what are your thoughts on the is-ought problem in ethics? I made a comment on Telegram somewhere that I thought this was just a sort of Anglo-empiricist dogma, that there's actually an is-ought problem. And it comes from David Hume, and Hume said that he sees these arguments in moral philosophy where people are going along and they're saying this is the case and this is the case and this is the case, and then suddenly they're saying this ought to be the case, and he doesn't see any necessity leading from statements about what is to what ought to be. And he just sort of puts that out there as a challenge. And I don't think it's actually that powerful or interesting. And the reason I don't think that's a very powerful or interesting idea, that I don't think there's a is-ought fallacy or an is-ought gap or anything like that, is it just contradicts how we actually speak about things that ought to be. And I want to use an analogy here between ethics and medicine. And this is very much a classical Greek idea of ethics. If you look at Plato's Republic, if you look at Aristotle, the understanding of moral philosophy is that it deals with the health of the soul in a way that's precisely analogous to how diet and training and medicine deal with the health of the body. Now, if David Hume were reading textbooks in, you know, medical school textbooks, and would be reading along about, say, the normal temperature, would he say that there's some vast gap that needs to be bridged between statements about what the normal temperature is and what one ought to do if somebody's running a fever or if once somebody's temperature is below normal? The fact is that there are certain things that are facts, and norms are facts. And that means that you can say that 98.6 or thereabouts is the normal temperature. That's what people's temperature ought to be if their body is healthy. And if they've strayed too far from that in one way or the other, medical treatment needs to be given them. I don't think there's any problem with that at all. I think that the cognitive faculties of human beings are well enough evolved that we can see, we can perceive, we can understand, we can know what norms are. And that applies to norms of health. And there are debates about this. There's no question about it. There are debates about what the normal temperature is or what the best diet is and so on and so forth. But there's no fundamental gap between statements about what is the case in terms of the body and health and statements about what one ought to do to be healthy or to regain one's health. It's just all part and parcel of health talk, medical talk, diet talk, training talk. And I don't see that there's a great problem there. And if there's some kind of philosophical problem, I think it's philosophy's problem. It's not a problem with the actual discourse about health. And the idea that doctors should somehow start stammering or shut up, just shut up, doctor, shut up. There's an is-ought problem here, and you need to shut up until you solve this problem for me. I would just say that's a you problem. Philosophers, especially in the Anglosphere, have generated a mental problem that they have for themselves, and they need to get over that problem on their own. And we cannot allow these people to basically talk us out of inquiry into the health of the body or the health of the soul. I think that norms are facts. Norms are facts. What makes a person spiritually healthy, morally healthy, are certain states of the soul. I think that those states can be described. I think that Plato in his Republic talks about the inner harmony of the soul, the proper relationship of the different parts of the soul. I think Aristotle in his Ethics talks about the nature of virtues, how to hit the virtuous mean between extremes of vice and so forth. And I just don't see that there's any problem there. So if there's an isot problem, it's in the mind of people like Hume. It's not a problem that vitiates moral discourse or medical discourse for that matter. So those are my immediate thoughts on that. But that's a very, very good question. And I also want to share something that Peter wrote to me, which I find really, well, I'm flattered by it. So I'm going to share it if I can find his message here. He said, "Your graduate school with Heidegger," I wrote a book called Graduate School with Heidegger, "especially is really amazing, and it was so much better and clearer than anything I've read Dugin write about Heidegger. I wish a lot more of the dissident right discourse could be at that book's level." Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. There was a person, and I forget his screen name. He was in the low IQ chat for Joel Davis, who said that he actually gave a copy of, or loaned a copy of my book, Graduate School with Heidegger, to one of his philosophy professors. And the guy looked at it and gave it back to him after a while and said, "This is really an excellent introduction to Heidegger, but he spends too much time talking about Heidegger's racist and fascist views." Well, I almost want to quote that and put it on the jacket of the next edition of the book. So anyway, I very much appreciate that, Peter. And he gave €5, so I appreciate that as well. So let me just check in with Entropy. Thomas writes in with €10. "Thank you. Nice to see Carl T. appear regularly here to Greg. Although being from Europe, you clearly won the discussion with Mark Collett for me." Well, thank you very much. Friedrich writes in with $10 and another philosophical question. "Greetings. Could you please talk to us a little from a philosophical perspective about the difference between wisdom and knowledge and its relevance to the dissident right? Great show. Thank you." Okay. Yes. There's a piece that I put up recently on the site on Plato's Dialogue Theages. I guess you were looking at that. And also, Colin Cleary wrote a piece on What is Philosophy recently. You probably were thinking of that as well. It's an argument that you find in Plato's dialogues that what wisdom is something somehow different from ordinary knowledge or from the other ordinary goods that are components of a good life. So, for instance, if you could ask people what the components of a good life would be, what would they like to have to flourish? They would say things like good health, money, a family, good looks. Good-looking people get away with a lot, there's no question about it. A good job, a pleasant environment to live in, and just physical things. Those are all components of a good life. But then you can ask, well, are all of these necessarily good for you? Or are there certain conditions under which these things might not be advantageous, might not be good for you? Is it possible for people to have too much money or to be too good looking or to be too healthy or to basically have any of the advantages of a good life and still not have those actually gel into a good life? And the answer is yes. So for instance, some people can have more money than is healthy for them. If you have a lot of money and you're very foolish, that is not a good situation to be in. You would be better off without a lot of money. If you take a lot of money and spend it foolishly and get yourself into trouble, that might actually be worse than not having it. The point is that all the things that you regard as components of a good life are not necessarily components of a good life if you don't use them well. So what is this thing that has to supplement all these goods to make sure that they gel into a good life? Well, the ability to make right use of all things. The ability to take up the right perspective on all things, to put them to the right use, to employ them in the right way so that you have a good life. And that is what Plato is getting at when he talks about wisdom. Wisdom is what philosophy pursues and what philosophy allows you to do. If you achieve wisdom, is it allows you to take the hand that's dealt you, right, and play your cards right and have a good life. Now, some people might have a very bad hand dealt to them by fate, and fate is a real force. Fate can deal you a good hand or deal you a bad hand, but it's how you play the cards that determines your ultimate life, how well you live or how badly. And the capacity to play your cards right or wrongly has everything to do with your lack of your level of wisdom or your lack of it. And so knowledge is a great thing, but not necessarily a great thing. Too much knowledge that's not used properly, those are not necessarily good. Knowledge has to be used wisely. The ability to make a world-ending weapon is knowledge, but obviously that screams out for wise use. And it's not necessarily a boon to the world if it's misused. So that's basically how Plato would distinguish knowledge and wisdom, or wisdom from any of the other things that people think are components of a good life. Yeah, knowledge is a good thing. Health is a good thing. A family is a good thing. And on and on and on. All of these are components of a good life, but they're not enough to have a good life if you don't use them wisely. And so wisdom is on a different plane entirely. You can say it's a higher form of knowledge or an ability, that's fine. But you have to recognize that unlike all these other things, you can't ever be too wise, right? You can have too much money for your own good. You can be too handsome for your own good. But you can never be too wise, because everything else needs the supplement of wisdom, but wisdom doesn't need anything to ensure that it redounds to a good life. And so one could almost say that being wise is enough to have a good life. Not entirely. Some people would say, like Aristotle, that you've got to have some external goods as well. But there were actually ancient philosophers who argued that simply being wise in and of itself is enough to lead a good life, even without a lot of external things that you would need to actually use wisely. So anyway, that's, I think, a very, very good question. And it's a question that all of us need to think about. This is why philosophy is the most important subject matter you could ever study in college or outside of college. Why? You might think that chemistry is really, really important, or biology is really important, or engineering is really important, and they are really important. But none of those things are components of a good life unless they're used wisely. And therefore, all of us have a stake in philosophy. No matter what we do for a living, no matter how we lead our lives, we all have to, again, play our cards right. And really, the pursuit of wisdom is what philosophy is all about. So, thank you for that. Keith, K-E-E-F, Keith writes in, Greg, can you give us Europoors who can't afford a paywall subscription a rundown of your article on might, right, and sovereignty, which came out last week and is behind the paywall? I apologize for that. We do have a paywall that encourages people to sign up, and the support that our paywall subscribers give is one of the things that keeps Countercurrents going. So, not apologizing too strenuously for that. But yeah, there are people who have to wait a month before they can see stuff behind the paywall. And sometimes that stuff is so tempting, like this article on might, right, and sovereignty that he wants to run down. Okay, I'll give you a basic rundown of what's in this article. It's a teaser. So you can, yeah, maybe you'll want to put aside some you know, cigarette money or Starbucks money and subscribe. Okay, so let me just find that piece. I apologize. We have so much good material at Countercurrents that things sort of get lost in the shuffle sometimes. Okay, yeah, it's called Might, Right, and Sovereignty. And basically what I say at the beginning is that oftentimes people fail to communicate effectively because they use the same word, but it has radically different connotations or denotations, right? I give the example of the word bark. Bark can be the voice of a dog or the skin of a tree. And if two people are talking and they're using bark in different ways, well, that's the stuff of comedy, right? This error is called equivocation. And it means calling different things by the same name and not knowing it. And I argue that sovereignty is a concept that's used equivocally in our circles, and that causes a lot of confusion. There's one sense of sovereignty that is a moral norm, and another sense of sovereignty is actual power. And you can put this as sovereignty as right versus sovereignty as might. And this confusion is multiplied because there's another distinction between types of sovereignty. There's national sovereignty and popular sovereignty. Now, national sovereignty is properly understood as a moral norm that nations don't answer to any higher political powers, but instead they control their own affairs and don't meddle in other nations' internal affairs. So sovereign nations are treated as equals under international law. And popular sovereignty, though, is the norm that the good of the people within a particular state is the highest law. So a legitimate government is one that pursues the good of the people as a whole. Now, it's very often the case in our circles, though, that you'll hear objections to the norm of national sovereignty along the following lines. A nation is only as sovereign as it is powerful, which means that the only sovereign nations are powerful nations, and weak nations have no real sovereignty at all. This implies that the equality of sovereign nations under international law is just a fiction, and it implies that when a powerful nation invades a less powerful nation, it makes no sense to talk about violating sovereignty, because if a nation is weak enough to be invaded, by that very fact, it's been proven to have no sovereignty. You're only as sovereign as you are strong. Now, the common objection to popular sovereignty is that the people don't actually rule. Instead, powerful elites rule. So again, sovereignty here is being reduced to power. Whoever has power over the state is sovereign. And if you're on the receiving end of state power, you, by that very fact, are not sovereign. Thus, it's meaningless to criticize any state for violating popular sovereignty. It just doesn't mean anything. The people as a whole do not exercise power. Therefore, you can't say that popular sovereignty is being violated if it doesn't even exist. Okay, and the objection that I have to both of these arguments is that they dismiss the very idea of norms. Moral norms don't describe what happens to be in the everyday world. They prescribe what ought to be. Now, this gets us back to the is-ought question. Moral norms really do talk about oughts. And ultimately, I would argue that they are facts, but they're not necessarily facts in an ordinary sense of the word, in the world, worldly facts, everyday facts, what's happening. So for instance, you might live in a society where lying and cheating are very common behaviors, where practically everybody's lying and cheating. That still doesn't make it right, because the norm is different from ordinary behavior. What people ought to do is different from what people actually do. However, it might be the case that when you describe what people ought to do, you're describing a certain fact, namely, what would make human beings perfect in terms of their spiritually perfect. Well, the spiritual perfection of man is what ethics is about. Okay. So a norm prescribes what ought to be in ordinary behavior, and it is itself ultimately, I think, a fact that we can understand. I'm a moral realist, okay? But norms are not things that we observe in day-to-day behavior. Normally, we observe subnormal behavior. And so average behavior, everyday behavior, is often not normal in the sense that it's not what ought to be. Okay? The everyday world is pretty much a mixed bag. There's a lot of good, a lot of bad, a lot of indifferent stuff. And moral norms are standards by which we distinguish between what's good, bad, and indifferent. Okay? So national sovereignty is a norm that prescribes how sovereign states treat one another. They have to recognize and respect one another's autonomy. And as far as this norm is concerned, it does not matter if one state is stronger than another. If a strong state violates the sovereignty of a weak state, the aggressor is wrong and the victim has been wronged. And it doesn't matter who's the stronger. The moral outrage is not altered if the aggressor gets away with it. And indeed, I say the longer this outrage persists, the greater the outrage. Evils don't become good magically with the passage of time, which is not to say that you can't have evils that become so entrenched that nothing can be done to reverse them. Ancient historical evils cannot be reversed. The victims and the perpetrators are long dead, right? You can't get justice for ancient evils. I'm practically reading the article, but that's okay. I've done that before on streams. So to preserve sovereignty, states cannot set up a power above them that forces them to all get along, because if a force like that existed, they wouldn't be sovereign anymore. It would be sovereign. So one solution for the problem of big states aggressing against smaller states is for smaller states to band together to counterbalance the power of larger states. Another solution that people have created consists of international bodies like the United Nations or NATO, which adjudicate disputes. But if they're truly international, namely relations between sovereign states, they can't take away the sovereignty of their members. And thus, you have to have a new category of relationship between these states that's not political, where one exercises sovereignty over another. Rather, they are all sovereign, and they relate together in terms that are called collegial. A collegial organization is a gathering of independent agents working together for common aims under shared norms, but without an overarching power that commands them. That's the way things like the UN and NATO are done. They're collegial organizations. They're colleges of sovereign entities. Now, members of these organizations can elect leaders, they can delegate powers, they can commission functionaries, but ultimately sovereignty is reserved by the member states. That was originally how the United States was put together. The idea was that the states retained sovereign power and delegated certain powers to the federal government. Of course, after the Civil War, that all became a dead letter. So advocates of the norm of popular sovereignty recognize that political orders inevitably have differences of power, and that power is always going to be exercised by the few over the many, just so that everybody else can get on with their lives. And if the few rule and the many are ruled, then how is this popular sovereignty? Well, popular sovereignty is the norm that the ruling elite has to act in the interests of society as a whole, the common good, as opposed to their own factional interests. When rulers fail to pursue the common good, they're wrong, and the people are the wronged party, and the moral outrage isn't altered if the elites get away with it, right? The longer they get away with it, the greater the outrage and the greater the necessity of change. So when people deny that sovereignty is normative, this is generally part and parcel of just denying norms as such. It's often expressed as the view that might makes right. But if right simply reduces to the power relations that exist at any given time, if whatever is is right, or if we can never say that things ought to be different, even though we might prefer them to be different, then why even talk about the good or right altogether? Let's just simply talk about facts. If might is right, then just get rid of talking about right and just talk about facts. These are the facts. We might wish them to be different, but we don't have any right to say they ought to be different. Okay, if right is meaningless in politics, it doesn't just imply that weak people have no rights. It also implies that the strong have no rights either. They do enjoy more power, but they've got to enjoy it while it lasts because somebody stronger is going to come along and take it away from them eventually, and they've got no grounds to complain because they can only complain on moral grounds if they lose, right? If might is right, you've got no grounds for complaint when you lose. Okay. Now, that's a very strange doctrine for dissidents to embrace. Dissidents, by definition, oppose the existing power structure. That makes us weak by definition. We might prefer that the political status quo be different, but if it's meaningless for us to say that the system is wrong and ought to be different, then why would anyone who does not share our preferences take us seriously? It's a trope in Western movies to point a gun at someone and declare, "You ain't talking your way out of this." But the truth is, in such a situation, the only thing we could do is talk our way out of it. In fact, one could describe the ideological component of metapolitics as talking our way into power, and nothing is more self-defeating than declaring moral language meaningless before we start. Now, it's fortunate, though, that many of the people who say that might makes right or right means nothing, they don't actually mean that. They have a very specific picture of might that makes right. They're thinking about outstanding, splendid individuals. They're thinking of kingly types. They're thinking of great lions. They're revolted when you point out the simple fact that great lions can be brought down by packs of jackals. You may be big and strong, but you've got to sleep sometime. And when you do, a bunch of skinny guys working together can end you. I'm stealing a line from one of my undergraduate professors who explained in precisely those words how Hobbes understood human equality. When Thomas Hobbes talks about human equality, basically what he's saying is that nobody is so powerful that a few people working together can't kill him. Okay? You may be big and strong, but you got to sleep sometime. Mediocre masses banded together are stronger than the splendid few. But that's not the kind of power politics they have in mind. They don't really believe that might is right. They believe in the inherent right of the noble to rule. But nobility is one of those pesky moral norms that they thought they had banished. So this is why I use this meme of Lisa Simpson, the Might Makes Right fan, getting her coffee topped up from a pot labeled ideologies that were crushingly defeated. There are a lot of people who stand for ideologies that were crushingly defeated, and you will still say that might makes right. Well, look, if you believe that might makes right, then you should believe that the ideologies that you are pining for are simply wrong, right? The noble cause of the South. It's possible, if you believe in moral norms, to say that the South was right, even though they were defeated. But you can't do that if you're a might makes right person. So the reason for sharing this meme, the reason I liked this meme, is to point out that a lot of people who precisely embrace paganism or National Socialism or the Confederacy, they can only do so if they actually believe that there are some standards over and above might that would give them the basis for saying that the cause of the South was right, even though they were defeated. Okay, so I think that's worth your €5, which you donated. Thank you very much. And so I hope you will eventually put aside some more money and join the paywall. But I've given you all a preview of what was behind there. So thank you very much for that. Okay, we have another question on entropy that was sent in by I'll Take My Stand in Dixieland, right? He sends $10. Thank you very much. Would you comment on Nima Parvini, also known as Academic Agent, and his preference for modernist elite theory in contrast with your emphasis on classical political philosophy and how this discussion is relevant to nationalists. Well, the entire thing that I just read basically deals with that issue. Parvini wrote a book called The Populist Delusion. I think it's what it's called, The Populist Delusion. I reviewed it earlier this year at Countercurrents. If somebody would link that in the chat, I would appreciate it. Anyway, in The Populist Delusion, he talks about elite theorists from Machiavelli up to people like Sam Francis and Paul Gottfried and so forth. And he basically argues that populism is delusional because people like Robert Michaels and Vilfredo Pareto and Sam Francis and others show that actually what happens is that small elites always dominate the body politic. And I pointed out that his argument doesn't follow. His argument is based on basically ignoring the normative nature of popular sovereignty. Popular sovereignty as a norm does not deny that in practice there will be people who exercise power within the state and people who just go about their business and have power exercised upon them. The norm of popular sovereignty is that the people who exercise power in the state ought to exercise that power for the good of the whole society, not for themselves or for their friends or for foreign powers that are bribing them or whatever. So I point out that that's simply a bad argument, but it's a bad argument that's deeply rooted in the very nature of modern political thought, going back to Machiavelli, where he starts, which is an attempt to dispense with normative political discourse and simply talk about power politics. You can't really do anything without norms. And I point out that the alternative to classical, the alternative to modernist elite theory, which is essentially Machiavellian from Machiavelli down to people like Sam Francis, the alternative to that is classical political philosophy. Classical political philosophy recognizes that sovereignty is an inherently normative idea, both popular sovereignty and also national sovereignty. So anyway, I think it's a good question, and thank you very much. So I've dealt with that, I think, pretty extensively. Unknown Californian, $5, thank you. Has Greg ever had a paranormal experience? Any thoughts on the occult? Is it real? I've never had a paranormal experience that I can think of. I wouldn't say I've had any paranormal experiences. I've had a few uncanny experiences that I would definitely like to have explanations for, but nothing ghosty, let's put it that way. Any thoughts on the occult? Is it real? I want to recommend that you read a book by Colin Wilson called The Occult. I think there's a whole lot to this, and I think that philosophy needs to figure out how to explain it. I took it very, very seriously when I was in graduate school. I wrote a doctoral dissertation on Kant and Swedenborg because I believe that Kant was constructing his critical philosophy in part to explain the possibility of things like remote viewing, which he believed actually took place. William James, who's another great philosopher, was very interested in paranormal phenomena as well. So I do think that there are real phenomena that need to be taken seriously by philosophy. So ABC writes in with $25. Average IQ for Jews in America is higher than the one for blacks, about 15 points. I think it's about 20 points. But there are 6 times more blacks than Jews, so they should have enough competent people to own their own music industry currently owned by Jews. There's a 5-point difference compared to whites, yet they own a lot. Why? Well, that's a good question. I think that Jews are very, very interested in cultural power. There are lots of market dominant minorities in America, but some of them are drawn to things like cheap hotels like Gujarati in America, the Patels who own hotels. And then there are other market dominant minorities who have a greater sense of destiny, and therefore they gravitate towards industries that give them power. Banking and the media are the two industries that Jews are most drawn towards. They're also drawn towards academia. It's will to power that drives that. And this is why Jews are massively overrepresented in these areas, because they want power in society. They don't want just wealth. They want power. They've got ungodly amounts of wealth, but they are willing to spend huge amounts of wealth to attain power and influence. And one of the things that they have done for decades, a better part of a century now, is they've gravitated towards music by outsider groups. And they promoted music by outsider groups. And the principal outsider group in America is Blacks. Now, I don't deny that Black people are talented in music, although frankly, I don't think that rap is music, and I don't get it. I have friends who listen to this sort of music, but I don't get it. I think it's extremely insipid music. I think blues is incredibly insipid music as well. I do think a lot of jazz is quite good, and there's some actually quite good soul music. You know, certain kinds of Black music are good. But there is this false narrative that's being spun out alongside promoting non-white musicians, especially Black musicians in America, which is, I think, fake. It's the narrative that jazz and popular music are deeply Black, entirely Black at their roots. I think that that's a grave injustice to many, many white musicians who contributed to these genres and actually made them significantly better. I think rhythm and blues, Black rhythm and blues and Black soul and Black blues, just pure blues, is often extremely insipid music. And I think that whites who took up some of these musical forms infused them with a great deal of white genius and also white musical forms and created something that goes far beyond Black music. So anyway, I do think that Jews have as a strategy of overturning the dominance of white culture in America have promoted non-white music. I would not be surprised if Jews were disproportionate in, say, Central and Eastern Europe at promoting gypsy music in those countries as well. I don't know for a fact if they do, but it would not surprise me, because that's the kind of subversive agenda that they engage in. Just as Jewish politicians and Jewish lobbying groups lobby to overturn normative whiteness, to open borders, they overturn the 1924 Immigration Act in America. They have worked in the cultural sphere to overturn white norms in the musical world. So it's not just IQ, it's will to power that's involved here. Okay, ABC also writes in with $10. Thank you. There are explicit national laws in all still white countries, and also international laws that effectively block every single one of the 10 solutions proposed by Jane Dunphy in his recent article at Countercurrents. Is this a coincidence solution? Well, yeah, our legal system is stacked against us. Again, largely because our society has been massively subverted against white interests. Jasper writes in with $75. That's very generous. And remember, folks, all of this is going to be matched. So this is super helpful. A while ago, you advised young women not to go to university, but some fields such as nursing and school teaching are well-suited for females, reinforce traditional roles, provide skills for motherhood and family life, and require higher education. Having our people in education and healthcare is also strategically valuable. What do you think? Honestly, I'm still not going to go for that. I don't see any reason why you can't have male nurses and male school teachers and encourage that. I would strongly encourage young women to skip college and go directly into being mothers rather than get a career, because a career can be a trap. It can be a career that basically is a way that you can run out your biological clock by studying in school and then trying to get established on a career path. I do think, however, that once women start a family, that we should give incentives to intelligent women who have started families and say, raise their kids to the point where they can go off to school if they are so inclined to public school them and if the public schools are good enough. Let's say that a woman has four kids and, you know, the youngest is now off to school. She's got her whole life ahead of her. She's got a lot more free time. I would give incentives for women like that, if they're also smart and good mothers, to start studying, right? Maybe they want to study nursing or teaching or any number of other things. Maybe they want to be a lawyer or a politician. But it would be great to give them incentives to do so after they've had a family, gotten that stuff out of the way, pretty much, while they're still fertile. Because people live a long time. Women live a long time after their kids grow up, after they live a long time after menopause. They might want to pursue careers at that point. But under the current system, going to college is, for women, it's a terrible waste of time. For men, oftentimes it's a waste of time. It's a brutal process of being hazed and demeaned and brainwashed and gaslit. But let's say we got rid of all the brainwashing and gaslighting and just had a normal, healthy educational system. Even in such a system, I would want to give incentives for women to first have families and then go to college. I think that that would be very, very sensible. So Jasper writes in with $31 again. In an alternate dimension, the intellectual leader of a growing white nationalist movement, Greg Johnson, has a wife and kids. He is forced to dress for Halloween with his family. What is his costume? I should have read this earlier and got Carl Thorburn to comment on this. What would my favorite Halloween costume be, or the Halloween costume I'd wear if I went out with the family to trick or treat? I don't know. That's a good one. I remember years and years ago when I was living in the Bay Area and they still did a big Halloween thing along Market Street all the way down to the Castro District. And I went in to San Francisco and was just watching all the costumes and I loved it. But my favorite costume was this couple that had put a mattress out in a sort of a median strip on Market Street. And they were sitting there dressed as John and Yoko in their bed for peace with their hippie wigs and their guitar, just watching the crowd. I thought that was absolutely hilarious. No, I would not dress as John Lennon or Yoko Ono, but I have to say that that was one of the wittiest costumes I've ever seen. But anyway, I love that. Thank you. That's a great question. I've got some questions from Eric here. Do you hate the white working class? No, I don't hate the white working class. I know there are some people in our movement who hate the white working class or say really nasty things about them. Richard Spencer certainly had a pretty, patronizing attitude about working class people. I understand Nick Fuentes has been going off on white working people. He wishes he could mace them or something like that. I don't know what to say about people like that. I think that, well, if they're sincere, they're bad people. And if they're not sincere, what the hell are they doing? This is not the behavior of a mature person who wants to be a political leader, right? I saw a clip from Fuentes ragging on white people, blaming all the Southern white people, right? Ragging on Southern white people and saying that they're responsible for all the bad behaviors of blacks, which is just a dumb idea from Thomas Sowell. But black people have cooler music. I just don't know what to say about stuff like that. But I'm not one of these white people who hate the white working class. Hell, my father was a member of the white working class. My father was a member of a union who went to work with a lunch pail. So I grew up as part of the white working class, and I certainly don't have contempt for these people. Why do our hostile elites loathe manual labor? Well, because they are moneylenders, professionals, and they associate manual labor with times in their past before they were a diaspora people, where sometimes they were forced to make bricks for the pharaoh. And so that is for them a symbolic of something degraded. Since they don't like to do their own physical labor, that means that they have to exist in other societies as a minority group that basically pay other people to do physical labor for them. It's just part of their evolution as a people over time. And one of the things that was great about the Zionist movement in the 19th century was the recognition that if Jews are to overcome the problem of anti-Semitism, they have to change their profile. They need to stop being a market dominant, wheeling and dealing and subversive, often minority, a minority that profits off the vices of the people around them, oftentimes. And they have to start doing manual labor again. They have to move to a country where they would be the majority and they would have to occupy all positions in the economy. And they would have to be producers of physical goods, physical value, not just people who basically manipulate symbols and charge interest and things like that. He also asks, what are my thoughts on recycling? Do I recycle? Yeah, I do recycle because I'm a just naturally thrifty person. And it just strikes me as an appalling sin to throw things away and never reuse them. So I'm the kind of person who saves jars and things like that. Eventually, when I move, I end up putting it all in the recycling bin, but I think, well, maybe I can use this for something in the future. So I do tend to do that. I think it's just natural thrift. And there's something horrific, given how many human beings are teeming across the surface of the planet, to use some things once and then throw them away. So they just, fill up the oceans and fill up the landfills and stuff like that. I would like more recycling to be done. Okay, so one more question from Eric. If you had to live in a non-Western country or city, which would it be? Good question. If I had to live in a non-Western, non-white society, I think I would live in, I definitely live in Japan. I just think the Japanese are so terribly interesting. They have such an interesting culture. I like a lot of things about Japanese culture. And I think that if I had to live in such a society, Japan is certainly the most civilized, and certainly the most prosperous, and certainly the cleanest of such societies. I'm not as attracted to Chinese civilization as the Japanese. So yeah, places like Taiwan or Singapore, they might have certain conveniences, but I don't find them as attractive. I did very much enjoy visiting South Korea briefly. I thought it was very clean. It was very modern. It had a pleasing aesthetic to it. So I guess that would be my second choice if I had to live outside the white world. I certainly would not live outside the white or Asian world. There's just not much attraction to the rest of the world as a place for me to live. So let's see if there are more questions here at Entropy. Oh, Komi Kobayashi, speaking of Asiatic names or Asiatic things, asks, is there room for a person who's a liberal white advocate in our movement? Well, yeah, absolutely. But I get your point, because obviously there's a whole lot of people who want to link white advocacy with a laundry list of ultra-conservative political add-on positions. And I do have to admit that some of these conservative political add-on positions do seem appealing to me, but I think it's the most important thing to just put together a movement that can work for white sovereignty. And that means that the more people from up and down the political spectrum that we can convince that they have an interest in maintaining a white civilization, the better. There are many things about me that I would consider to be more left-wing than right-wing. I certainly like the aesthetics of places where leftists live. I like urban areas, for instance. I like walkable communities and stuff like that. I like high culture. You can't go anywhere in a major city. You can't sit down in a concert hall without being surrounded by disproportionate numbers of libs for whatever reason. I try and figure out ways I can reach these people and tell them, look, you think that by filling America up with people from Africa and Latin America and the Middle East, that you're somehow going to create a permanent lock on power so that you can ensure that feminism and the arts and environmentalism and walkable communities and all these things are, dominant. And it's just not going to happen because the people that you're bringing in don't have any appreciation for these things. I just want them to see that the left as well as the right have an interest in maintaining the whiteness of our civilization. And it's a big task. And yeah, I find Gab to be not a great place to recruit people for white advocacy who are outside extreme rightist bubble, sort of discourse bubbles. So, yeah, I've written about this. I did a piece at a Scanza Forum conference on this. I've talked about getting away from right-wing sectarianism again and again. It's a danger. It's a danger, and I'm especially opposed to the people who want to link our issues with, say, Christian theocracy. Of course, you can't go anywhere on Gab without seeing those sorts of memes. So, yeah, it's an important question. Thank you very much. It's certainly part of my agenda. I would like to create as broad a white positive pro-white movement as possible by showing that all different white groups have an interest in maintaining white homelands for themselves. I don't envision a whitetopia as a one-party state with right-wing policies. I envision a whitetopia as a place where white people are going to be arguing about abortion and taxes and zoning and stuff like that, just like we are now, except that we're only going to be doing it amongst ourselves, and we're not going to have the option of allying with non-whites to gain temporary political advantages against our own flesh and blood. That's my vision of things. Somebody writes in, Sam Dixon is liberal in the genuine sense. To be honest, Jared Taylor is too. Pro or anti-liberal or conservative is irrelevant. I like Jason's point about being against anti-whiteism more so. Okay. Archie writes in, Japanese food is definitely much safer than China's. This is definitely my impression. Let me just see if there are some more questions here. Archie writes in, I met a Polish girl in uni that said, I'm here to meet a professional man so I can be an educated stay-at-home mother that homeschools her children. That's good. I think the best degree for young women to get is the MRS rather than the BA or the BS, the Mrs. degree. I knew when I was in university a lot of young women who were quite frank about looking to going there to get their MRS degrees. However, the truth is that even women who went there saying they were going to get their MRS degrees, a lot of them ended up getting sucked into careers. Why? Because of affirmative action for women. They were given all kinds of privileges around campus. And then as soon as they had their degrees, or even before they had their degrees, oftentimes, they would be courted by employers who are trying to get them for affirmative action purposes. And so once they set foot in that environment, oftentimes they found themselves being tempted away from their initial aim. So anyway, I do think that is something that we need to take into account. So one more glance at some of these questions. I just want to make sure that I haven't forgotten anything. I jotted a few things down and I seem to have gotten all the questions. So folks, tomorrow, Catherine S., one of Countercurrents' best writers, is going to be joining Nick Gilvey on the Writer's Block. That will start at 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time, and 10 p.m. Central European time, where Nick is. Same bat channel, not the same time, but the same channel. So please tune in tomorrow for Nick on the Writer's Block. And I'm looking forward to being back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. Thank you.